Welcome everyone once again to the Football Scholars Forum. We are joined today by Laurent Dubois to talk about his new book, The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. And it's a real pleasure to have Laurent with us to talk about this book that's really an incredibly accessible volume, not only about the game, but a feature of many of our participants' work. And I just wanted to start off by one thing, how excited I am to talk about this book with everyone, but also to thank Laurent for including the Football Scholars Forum in his acknowledgments of the book. I think one of the highest ambitions that Peter and I had for this group when we started it 8 years ago now was to provide a forum to exchange ideas and to talk about work, and to have that acknowledged in the book is a moment of joy for us. So I wanted to thank Laurent for that. Before we move on to discussing the book, I just wanted to quickly remind everyone to mute when not speaking, to use the chat queue for questions as they come up for discussion. You can use the queue to virtually raise your hand so I can queue up those questions and present them to Laurent, and to use FSF language as the hashtag on Twitter. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Laurent and ask him to tell us a bit about the genesis of the book.
Thank you, Alex, and definitely it's really heartfelt acknowledgement that this group has really, really helped shape the what my thinking and all that went into the book. So it's kind of nice to be able to mention that and to bring the book back to this group. So thanks a lot for inviting me today. This book was actually not my idea. It was something that Basic Books came to me about. They partly just because of magazine work I'd done, and the editor was someone I'd worked with at Harvard Press on another book. And they have a series, it's not really marketed as a series, but they've had a series of books that are basically about different kind of cultural forms and explaining them to kind of a broader audience. So there's a ballet one, an opera one, a book called How to Listen to Jazz by Ted Goya is the most recent one. So they kind of envisioned it in that series and jokingly sort of said, like, we really want a book about something that a lot of people actually do now, you know. So that was kind of the idea, and then I kind of took them up on it. I thought it was an exciting idea, and this is what I wrote. I mean, it ended up being, going through different versions and phases, and ended up kind of what I think is hopefully a relatively simple structure around, you know, the kind of main actors of the game, the chapters each kind of named by either players or a referee, manager, or fan. With the last chapter, but then using that sort of, you know, that relatively straightforward structure to get at various depths of history, and both in terms of tactics and the culture of the game, and just I tried to you know, bring in stories from different parts of the world. Obviously, like, a main emphasis or a main desire I had was to sort of make women's soccer a sort of core part of the story throughout, just to kind of make it an interwoven, rather than kind of a separate topic. So that was one of my goals. So that's essentially what I was hoping to do. Managed to keep it the length that they wanted, which is not my strong suit. I tend to write books that are too long, but this one was, and it was interesting to, partly I guess because I had been done writing in a bunch of different fora, you know, kind of the goalpost blogs at New Republic, and then the blog that a bunch of us had were involved in, on women's soccer in 2015 at Sports Illustrated. So it was kind of using a little bit more of that voice, pretty different than somewhat different than the voice I used in Soccer Empire in 2010, maybe more personal at times and autobiographical, as a way of making it, you know, the idea is really for it to be extremely broadly accessible, so that if, you know, just someone's curious about soccer, they can pick it up. Hopefully it's also still of interest for those who already know about the sport and kind of introduces different elements. So that's the ambition, and, you know, it's been great to hear some initial reactions. It's just been out a couple weeks. I did an event with Gwendolyn Oxenham here a few weeks ago. We talked about each other's books, so that was kind of a fun launch event here. But so I'm just looking forward to people's thoughts.
Great. Thanks so much, Laurent. I wanted to ask about something that you mentioned, actually. Really enjoyed reading this, by the way. It was, I thought David's description on the back cover was very apt. It's an anthology to please veterans, a gentle mediation on the game of soccer, critical when necessary, but it's a real treat to read. And I really enjoyed it. I wondered how, as you fit within that straightforward structure that you just described, the major actors in the game, how the different works that you draw more heavily on, sources that we've discussed in this forum, actually, Roger's book, David's book, just to name a couple, how you kind of chop them up and put them into different chapters where they're... It seemed at first glance complicated to do that, right? Like the straightforward structure of the actors did you a favor in some ways, but it also meant kind of just pursuing those different strands in each of the sources. Was it actually that complicated? And did you, in selecting those sources, deliberately pick out works that you thought were more accessible in how they had been written rather than, you know, taking, you know, more recent articles or edited anthologies that are a little bit more in academic language and kind of carving them up into more accessible language? Could you just talk about that process a bit?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely did turn to partly just turned to, you know, these books, that these great books that for me kind of helped me understand certain things that going in, there were things I felt like I knew better and others that I felt like I needed to kind of sort of try to get a better handle on as well. And these were books that I had read, but I kind of returned to with a more attentive eye. I mean, I obviously wanted to pull out particularly interesting anecdotes. And also, yeah, these are books that I thought were, you know, that I liked the writing of as well. So I wanted to pull in their voices. There is a way in which it's kind of a pretty, you know, it's drawing heavily on other people's own insights, obviously, into the game. So I was looking for quotes and language from them that, you know, I could kind of foreground as well. So, but it one thing about writing for this kind of press, and it was an amazing, I mean, Basic Books, I think, is the best experience I've had with the press, is that the editor is very hands-on, so that I would write a chapter, send it to the editor's name is Brian Distelberg, and he would like pretty intensively respond and edit and give me suggestions right there, you know, kind of like the next week. So his insight, and he kind of, sometimes I overdrew, you know, so he was kind of helping me trying to get me to hone the voice to the right kind of level. And at first I definitely probably quoted too much and sometimes was more detailed than, you know, what the ultimate form is. So there was this kind of weaving together process. I mean, part of the thing was that I wanted, you know, I've set up the structure with the positions, but I needed to do certain kinds of things chronologically or introduce, you know, there was a sort of order that things had to be in just historically, I thought, to give people. So probably the most complicated thing was interweaving the stuff about tactics into, and the stuff about history into the form, which is, of course, each chapter is kind of structured around particular individuals, and those individuals come from different time periods as well. So like, I guess, interweaving or figuring out how to mix chronology, more kind of direct tactical stuff, and then more anthropological stuff was a bit of a challenge. And it took a lot of rewriting, you know, so there was the chapters themselves, I guess, mostly contain what they, in each case, what they originally contained in the draft. I didn't do a ton of moving around. But then the way that they worked out shifted a lot over time through editing and having friends read it and that kind of thing. So, but I did want to, you know, I obviously was using the biographical, which I just always think is a good way in for people. So in particular, Roger's book was, you know, that was really important. Realizing in particular, because he has such great material about Gigi in particular, and also Gerson, but like figuring out that writing about those midfielders in the Brazil team would be kind of an interesting way to talk about a very classic moment, but in a maybe slightly less known register than if I had made Pelé like the center of the forward chapter, and so forth. So, and definitely inverting the pyramid was, you know, totally essential, as well as Jonathan's goalie book, just in terms of, you know, giving me a kind of grounding from which to think from as well. So, But then I also looked to journalists like McIlvaney or other folks who just had, you know, written at the time to try to pull out, you know, what I thought of as kind of vivid prose. Of course, Galeano is, you know, interwoven. And of course, Peter's work is, in, you know, so there's all those voices, I think, were there. So it was definitely an attempt to kind of communicate those and kind of utilize them for the within this structure. So.
Great. Thank you. I'll pass the ball over to Peter with a question.
Since you were telling us about the evolution of the book and the structure, I was interested in hearing more about why you structured it the way you did. I thought as soon as I opened the table of contents, I thought one of my favorite football books, Arthur Hopcraft's The Football Man, which came out first, I think, in the 50s, and then sort of the edition that I and others read came in the 80s sometime. But it follows the same type of organization by character, if you will. So you have the goalkeeper, the defender, the midfielder, the forward, sort of the team on the pitch. Then you've got the manager, and then you've got the referee, and then the fan. So I was curious, why did you pick those characters? And were there other characters that you were considering including in the story, or maybe thinking about it later that you might have wanted to include, and how might have the book been different in a sense?
Yeah, it actually was a pair. So my original proposal actually had 11 chapters and started with the pitch and then had chapters more on institutions and money. You know, basically, in the original plan a chapter on federations and FIFA, and I had this kind of a little bit more ambitious sense of sort of scaling, you know, from the pitch out to these other kinds of institutions that surround the game, I actually was going to have a chapter just on like commentators, which ends up that's kind of actually now part of the fan chapter. So that material on Alou that you wrote about, and you know those. So there was more, actually. It was going to be an 11 chapters originally. And as I wrote, you know, once I had the first four on the pitch itself, on the players, and I felt like I'd gotten that down, the referee, manager, and especially the fan chapter, you know, there obviously could be a lot more. And in some ways, the fan chapter, I think, was the most complicated to write just because there's so much beautiful stuff. I mean, there's so many things one could have done there, and so many works, and also trying to figure out how to balance, you know, there are very powerful voices that have written about that and sort of balancing that with having still my own consistent voice that you know, connected with the earlier chapters was a challenge. I mean, in some ways, the referee chapter was like a fun one to write, in part because that's not that there's not some stuff about it, but it's certainly the one about which there's maybe the least, like, you know, there's not as much of a profusion of writing. Certainly by referees and about referees in quite the same way. So, but that was, I mean, and I think once I realized that I hope people will have this thought when they look at the, you know, they look at the contents, it sort of does, it is meant to be a little bit of like a guide, you know, like here's the basic things that you sort of need to know, while maybe also using that, I was going to say a trick. It's not really a trick, but like using that as a kind of seemingly fairly straightforward, but then like the goalie chapter goes into territories that maybe aren't as expected in terms of philosophy or those sorts of things. And, you know, each of them have something that hopefully like the midfielder chapter with Total Football, where they bring you into other realms. And I wanted throughout to kind of get this mix of culture and so forth. The fan chapter was interesting because, you know, as you can see, I have this very like extremely broad sense of what could be a fan, which is like basically almost anyone who is interested in soccer. And that was part of it, you know, that one could obviously have delved much more into certain cultures of fandom as people have, you know, as well. And there's, again, those were sorts of choices, partly because the valence of the book was meant to be a welcome, you know, so the idea wasn't to sort of say, you know, these are real fans and you who reading this book might not be, or whatever, like there was that kind of, so there, you know, that sense of, and then a little bit of a tilt that I've always had a little bit towards the international sort of area versus, you know, other kinds of zones of football, which I think is just, I mean, that's just a little bit my bias, my interest in terms of my bias, but yeah. And I think that the, there was obviously, I felt like I wanted to touch on different parts of the world as much as I could while retaining a kind of coherence as well. So, and I just felt like the structure allowed me to do that. So,
yeah. Great.
I don't know, does that kind of answer your question or?
Oh, it's really interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, it evolved a bit organically. And then then there was a moment where I basically decided that I was going to subsume the kind of institutional stuff and the money stuff into other parts, you know. So basically the manager chapter has within it like a tiny little bit of the money stuff that I, you know, could have and might have, you know, want, I mean, might have in another world spent more time on. But the version that exists is kind of as less ambitious in a way than the original, because the original would have kind of gone out from the pitch into other layers of sort of structure and power around the sport in the way that, you know, a lot like Goldblatt does, or way other books I think do, and your book does, obviously. So, you know, that was a choice to, once I had gotten to about 60,000 words with what I'd writing, and I was like, okay, I need to figure out what to cut out. So
thank you.
Great. Let's turn next to Lindsay Krasnov.
Hi, thanks so much. Laurent, I've really enjoyed this work of yours, and it strikes me in a variety of different ways, especially because a lot of the people who I've been interacting with over the past year or two have been outside of the academy, but who are either working in the sports field or heavily involved in it, whether from the fandom side or they're just following it more closely. And one of the things that they continuously say is, we had no idea that fill in the blank, which I think amongst many of us, we kind of take for granted, but you know, it's very much bridging that transom between the academic writing and thinking about the sport and you know, what is transmitted or circulating out with the more general public. And you've touched a little bit on some of the challenges in this particular process. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what was one of the more the larger challenges in the process of getting this book out, whether conceptually or writing, and how you overcame that, and also what surprised you the most about this particular sort of book process, which is quite different from what most of us usually do on the academic side.
Yeah, thanks for that. And thanks again. Yeah, it means a lot that to get that you enjoyed it. I think that the challenge was about the voice in a certain sense, like how to figure out a voice that would be, what would do what I was hoping to do, which is, you know, kind of invite people in who, invite a lot of different people in, right? So I didn't want to write something that someone who knew and is passionate about the game, you know, was like, oh, well, I don't need this. It's, you know, it's basic, you know, hopefully that, so there was some desire to bring them in, but also like this simultaneously, to make someone who really is picking this up with kind of a very limited knowledge of the game, or because, you know, they're just kind of, they feel like they want to learn about it, to be welcomed in. So that was I think is a little bit of a difficult balance for me. I had written a trade book before on this history of Haiti a few years ago, which is a very similar process and this very similar kind of challenge. Obviously a very different topic, but the idea there was, you know, I wanted to kind of present the history of Haiti to a broad audience while of course doing justice to the scholarship and you know and doing the best I could to represent what we know as a kind of scholarly field too. So so I had that experience would kind of help with this one. So I think that was, and the challenge in some ways was just holding the piece, figuring out how to hold the pieces together. And it's really the prose, you know, because on some level, unlike, I already had faced this in writing Soccer Empire, and I'm sure we've all faced this, is that the, you know, what exactly are the temporalities and the layers of temporality when you write about sport, you know, from the instant, you know, the few minutes of a game to the game itself, to then these much larger kind of historical depths, you know, that are at work. And I found that to be a challenge already in Soccer Empire, which was, you know, for me, a little bit of a first in a book, in that my prior books had really been historically event-based, you know, had been basically chronological, like when I wrote about the Haitian Revolution or whatever. It was basically chronological, contained, often driven by political events. So already I, you know, realized when I started writing about soccer that that's a different, you know, there's a kind of different challenge there. And in this one, that came to the fore. So But the solution that I came to was once I found a kind of way of writing, to use that essentially as the thread, you know, so hopefully that ties together, you know, what could be, I don't know, it's like moving from Maradona to Drogba or whatever, you know, these, I found kind of ways to try to make the transition, and then stepping back from the narrative anecdotes to some broader points and trying to crystallize things was the other type of challenge. And that there, the editor did really help, because I do tend to, sometimes I didn't do that enough in the earlier drafts. I didn't really, like, myself kind of make some of the broader points I was trying to, you know, in the early drafts, I really was foregrounding particular stories and then kind of weaving them together. But in the later version, there was a bit, you know, just more of me kind of stepping back and saying, declaratively saying things about the sport, you know, which I do think is important. You know, whether you get it right or wrong is a question. That's always a little daunting, because you're sort of making pretty big claims. But I do agree that it's kind of necessary too, that people will, you know, will want to have some of that. So, and when I eventually, it was very, of course, near the end of the process that I figured out how to write the introduction around the kind of definitional, the play around the definitional, like, what is soccer? And I think I couldn't have written that without writing the chapters, but then once I figured out how to do that, that helped kind of, I think, solidify the link between the bigger questions and then the kind of details, which is the introduction kind of tries to do as well. So, but I think, you know, as you can all imagine, the challenge was that there's, you know, you could write, even just with the same exact structure, you could write a totally different set of stories, right? There's like a fairly infinite number of possible choices that one could have made about who's important and what you want to foreground. So, I was definitely aware of that, but, you know, when, you know, you choose what kind of seems compelling at the time or what I had in my mind. Teaching had been a really important resource, because many of these things are things that I have chosen to teach about or talk about in lectures. And so I thought, okay, well, that's meaningful that I've decided to use these in class. And that means they probably have some, you know, communicative value. So, yeah.
Great. Thanks, Lindsay.
Yeah.
A question from Adam next.
Hi, Laurent. Thank you very much. I really am enjoying your book, too. I have a more general question that's not, I guess, specifically about the book. And I'm new to the forum, and I'm new to football studies, so I apologize if this is something that you have all spoken about before, but I wanted to get your take on something. I teach at High Point University in North Carolina also, and I teach a first-year seminar called Sport and Collective Identity, which is essentially about what it means to be a fan. So when I got your book, I read the first couple chapters and I skipped to the end because it seemed that it was most relevant to what I've been talking about in class this semester. And there's a question that has come up to me for me and a couple other things that I've read recently. And I just want to know what you and maybe others in the forum think about it. But when we're talking about fans and sports, is there something that differentiates us soccer fans from fans of other team sports? You know, are there feelings that that authors try to capture that write about these things that are different feelings than maybe an American football or a hockey fan has?
Yeah, that's a great question. And of course, anybody else who wants to weigh in on this. In the book, there is a kind of thread that is kind of my take and response to the various crises of American soccer fandom, you know, that we are all familiar with, notably this year, and kind of speaking a little bit to that. And I mean, my own take has always been that that American soccer fandom is fine and in large ways, and kind of it's fine as something different from the dominant sports culture. I mean, in other words, that the idea that the goal of soccer should be to be like other American sports in its valences in this country is maybe not the right project, you know.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So I kind of emphasize that. So in that sense, I mean, I do that. So specifically in the United States, soccer fandom is different from other sports precisely because it has this kind of interesting marginality, which also has to do with its international, you know, orientation in many cases, the fact that it's not only fixated or even largely fixated on the U.S., even though fans, you know, also want to support, of course, American soccer. So those are, I think, those are differences within the U.S. And then there is a way in which, and it's, you know, Peter Alleggi was the first the person who originally introduced me to Bromberger many years ago, and I've always been kind of guided by that argument that not that there's something, you know, fun. I mean, there are obviously elements of this that happen with other team sports, but I do try to lay out that there's, like, I think there is something about the way a soccer match works as theater that, you know, kind of generates, you know, it's a particular kind of relationship. And that, and coming back again and again to the fact that it, the fact that it is so available and useful and culturally significant in so many different, radically different spaces, you know, that that this form of theater kind of can become a part of conversations in so many different sites, to me, I think is this, it continues to be this really fundamentally interesting question, and that's how I like to pose it in the class. So it's, you know, it's that question of, like, why it is that this form has been able to, you know, do what really almost no other form has, which is to kind of have that level of persistent interest across the globe in situations that you would have to describe as just radically different, cultural, linguistic, religious, everything. So that I guess keeps, the mystery is at the heart of that, I think, compels me, and I try to address in the book, and it's kind of at the center of when I teach about it too, because I just think it's an interesting fact that I don't know, you know, that we have the answers to, but this basic kind of anthropological question, or a philosophical question, if you will, but the fact that it's across cultures, I think, you know, makes it a particularly interesting one. And so I try to, again, address that in various ways, just by taking up examples of how, you know, whether it's obviously, you know, in Latin America or Africa or elsewhere, how, you know, these particular ways in which the game gets oriented. So, but I don't know if others want to join in on that particular question about, you know, U.S. fandom. And the other point of this was obviously that's in the U.S., the gender, you know, the fact of women's soccer being what it is always has to be at the center of the conversation, and hopefully tried to make that the case in this book as well.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, I love in that chapter at the end where you say that fandom offers a spectrum of possibilities that is reshaped and reconstituted by those who decide to be fans at any one place and time. Because it allows for that variety. In my class, I mean, I'm a Spanish professor, so I sort of force La Liga and I force the Barcelona Real Madrid rivalry on my students. A lot of them that have no interest in soccer, and they always want to talk about, you know, the latest scores in the NFL or the NCAA tournament or anything something. And so it's I feel like a lot of times I'm just trying to convince them, no, you need to be soccer fans. And of course, you know, it doesn't quite work that way, but you've given me some good material to use. So
I mean, my students are, I have a homework assignment every weekend, which is to watch or play in a soccer game. And then we actually just begin class by, I ask them, you know, just tell me what they watched. And it's, you know, they're on some level, it's pretty predictable. A lot of them watch an EPL game or whatever. And a lot of them here at least come in, I mean, there are a lot of them are international students and they come in with a pretty strong, you know, I've got some pretty deeply intense fans, but others who aren't as much, but that's kind of interesting. And actually, so I just kind of make that, and that's kind of at the beginning of the course, I'm like, whether you know, this is the forum we're studying, so you have to watch it. And that's, you know, not whether you like it or not, but that's kind of like, you know, it's like the reading or something in the class. And I do think, I mean, it's interesting. Of course, here we're always talking about basketball at Duke, you know, and whenever I teach it in the spring, the dramas of the basketball season are on their minds often. So, but I do, and I, over the years, I've ended up invariably just addressing the football, soccer, like history, the history of American football, and this kind of curious development, and that helps too, I think, because that sort of sets up as a kind of clear cultural and social question, like what is the difference, you know, why these sports that have common roots end up so radically different, and in particular at a university, how the history of American football is so imbricated with the history of Ivy League and other universities, and you know why that might be. I find to be a helpful thing because they don't necessarily know the history of American football either.
Sure.
So that's been, I didn't do that originally. I was just like, I'm only talking about soccer, but now I actually kind of address it head on as a way to think just comparatively about what, you know, what the ideological resonances are of different sports. So.
Great. Thank you so much.
Great. Next question is from Daniel.
Yeah, I don't have a good connection today, unfortunately. Yeah, I don't know why. I already changed rooms, etc. I also give my students a weekend assignment, which is when my favorite club, Hanover, wins, they should come of the week and say congratulations to me. And if Hanover loses, they should not talk about it and be silent. So that's my weekend assignment. But seriously, I have some questions. First of all, why did you not have a chapter on ownership, on owner? This is for me a very relevant issue. As a German, in Germany, it's not allowed private ownership, but my favorite, Hanover 96, they have an owner who's pushing for allowing a private ownership. So that's one question. Then how do you come, the fact that the US did not qualify for the World Cup must disappoint you, and I hope it will not affect the book selling. And Red Bull Leipzig case, yeah, that's another issue. And they tricked, because the name is officially Rasenbull Sport Leipzig, but they put an abbreviation that sounds similar. And finally, at about when you started to develop an interest in soccer as a scholar, and from my understanding, you're a full professor. Do you think you could have written such a book at an earlier stage of your?
Thanks for all these. Yeah, those are great questions. I mean, as I said, the ownership was going to be part of the original plan. And partly it was just accepting and realizing my own limitations.
Sorry.
Can you hear okay now? Everything okay?
I think so. Probably just a tricky connection from Daniel.
Okay. I'll just continue. So originally I did want to have much more on the kind of structures, and it was partly just realizing and accepting my own limitations on my understanding and knowledge of that. As I tried to write about it, I realized that my own just comprehension about the global kind of context of the finances around football was, you know, I was dependent on some of the book on Soccernomics and those kinds of books, which I know are just, you know, one part of it. But I didn't feel, yeah. So that's, of course, it's a huge part of the game and should be. And, you know, and other books, I think, deal with it very well. I mean, David Goldblatt's book, but it was because of decisions about what to do to try to at least hint at some of that, but also, you know, focus the story in other places. I mean, I was reminded of in 2010, I was at the South Africa World Cup, and I was with Simon Cooper during the Ghana-US game when, you know, the US was losing, and he was glum, and he explained to me, he's like, you know, every step forward in a World Cup, during the tournament is larger book sales for us. So, you know, you need to, like, that there's this definite correlation between kind of World Cup presence and book sales in the US around soccer. So, so that's, I guess, too bad. But at the same time, you know, we'll see. I do think that on the academic question, so, and, you know, Peter will remember this because he was kind of my early Yoda in football studies, that I really started writing about football in 2006 after the France-Italy World Cup, and specifically around Zidane's headbutt. So I began, as a scholar who had written on French Empire and French colonialism, and I was always interested in kind of questions around immigrant groups in France as that's like going back even to graduate school. So that was my entry point, was the nexus between immigration and race in France and the football as a kind of theater in which that was defined. So, or articulated. And that, so when I wrote Soccer Empire, which was in 2010, I wrote that, you know, with an academic press, and it was just at the point that I became full professor. So it wasn't like my full professor book, I guess, exactly. But I did think it was considered as part of what I was doing and something that I was able, you know, to incorporate into the scholarly profile. This book is definitely different in that it's, really, it's a larger audience book. I don't know that it would count in the same way for just kind of professional and tenure and that kind of stuff. And it's a really different kind of story. And obviously the notes are, it's a synthetic work, and there's really basically almost no original research in it. You know, it's not based on In Soccer Empire, there actually was original research of certain kinds, at least, and archival work. So there's a difference there. So there's definitely, obviously, a freedom to write like this. I see it as much an outgrowth of my teaching and the blog that I developed around my course, and then writing shorter pieces for magazines. So it's like part of, it's definitely come out of my academic life, but the teaching part of it was important. I mean, I think, I don't know that I would be able to have been able to write the book if I hadn't been able to had the opportunity to teach for several years about soccer, and therefore develop a kind of way of basically, you know, because in that class I'm speaking to roughly the same people that I'm speaking to in the book often, which is people who are curious but not necessarily, you know, knowledgeable about it. So but I'm also fine with the U.S. not being in the World Cup for complicated reasons, but I have my other teams, you know, that I'll be rooting for. So.
Thanks.
Yeah, but you know, in 2026, I hope they can participate as hosts.
I would love that too, of course. You know, partly because I myself am planning to go to the Women's World Cup in France next year, which I'm excited about as well. But I think, yeah, obviously the hosting here would be amazing for soccer in the States and for us personally, since we would be able to see a lot of games.
Great. Peter, would you like to go next quickly? I'm going to get a typed question from Andrew Lee and then relay it to Laurent, but you can go ahead while we get that.
Why don't we let Sean go, because I've asked one already, and I see his hand raised.
Thank you. I missed that raised hand. Sean, do you want to go ahead?
Sure. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I keep getting messages like Daniel saying my internet connection is not good. I'm in Brazil. So Laurent, I just, first of all, I wanted to say that I ordered your book, before my trip and it did not arrive. So I was looking forward to reading it, and now I'm, after this conversation, I'm even more excited to, have a read. So I have some, questions that are a little blind. I haven't even been able to access the table of contents, but I'm getting a sense of the book, through the conversation here. There were, some topics that I was wondering if you address, and if you do in the book, if you could just maybe speak to them a little bit. But one in particular, I was just in Argentina and was shocked to find that opposing fans are still banned from attending first division games. I thought that this was a temporary thing, that it's apparently continued for the last 5 years. Opposing fans are only allowed in for Libertadores, Sudamericano games. And so I'm just wondering if you address the topic of fan violence in particular, but violence in general as a language of football. The other thing I was wondering about is the video, the VAR, if that is addressed, and how that impacts football as a language.
Yeah, those are both. I mean, I do take them up a little bit in the fan chapter, which again is something that it's just shorter than what I originally intended. In which, in the longer version, I would have had a kind of fuller chapter on the media and just all these different forms of media over history, which is now in there, but not to the same extent. And in the same way, I definitely have a little bit on fan violence, although it's rather English centric, you know. So it's like using Buford and Robson's book on Millwall and a few other pieces. So it's addressed there in a certain way, but it's maybe not as central as, you know, as it could have been. So again, that was a difficult choice, because I was trying to figure out how to layer in like all of these different forms of viewing the sport that take, you know, lots of different shapes. And in some ways, while that's central, I see it as, you know, like important, but also a smallish group. I mean, like on some level, in terms of the global culture of the game, one particular valence of it. I think probably because of my general rosiness in the book. I mean, like it's a kind of it's maybe too nice about soccer. You know what I mean? It's got it, you know, like, again, if I'd had the sort of chapters on money and FIFA and so forth, I think it would have taken a different tone. But there's basically a fairly like romantic and celebratory, you know, like angle to the book, in that I'm returning to the things that I think are, you know, make the game amazing and great and that kind of stuff. So, you know, and whether that's a good choice or not, we can discuss, but that was, so I didn't know exactly how to, it's true that I mean, I use a moment, you know, there's this moment in Buford's book where he ends up participating and kind of talks about the power of violence in a certain way, in a certain register. And I wanted to include some of that as opposed to a more, just to render a little bit more complicated, that, and I do try to address the fact that this, the kind of, you know, that there's this kind of complicated spectrum of activity, in which the lines are a little complicated to draw at sometimes, right? So the kind of a condemnatory, I mean, there's obviously things to condemn, but there's a kind of sense of the complexity around kind of passion and fandom and the sport, try to sort of address it in that way. So, but, you know, I'll be curious when you read it, you know, if you think it's, if the balance is right on that as well. So it's true that that last chapter on the fan was hard to write, and that there were so many particular things I think I could have done that I didn't end up doing, you know, in terms of, especially since there's such amazing work, you know, anthropological work and kind of contemporary work on different fan groups in, you know, in Argentina and elsewhere. So, you know, those were definitely places where I could have, I thought about doing more and just didn't figure out a way how to fit it in. Certainly around African fandom too. So there are bits obviously from Peter's book and from a number of other works that I think capture things really, really nicely. But I tended towards kind of cultures of fandom without as much of an emphasis on violence per se.
Thank you. That's great. I don't know if you heard my other question was about the VAR, the video assistant referee.
Yes.
I had some really interesting conversations in Argentina. Everyone seems to think they want it, and not too many people had actually seen it in use.
Yeah.
Like in a Confederations Cup, and just how it really can wind up changing
the game.
Flow of the game and the way the game is experienced. Just wondering if it's addressed and if
it is. I mean, partly
if you have an opinion about it.
I do have a fairly anti-VAR opinion. In fact, I did write a piece in the Wall Street Journal that's kind of essentially a critique of VAR, or a defense of soccer as unreasonable and unfair as in some level. So, and you can check that out, and that was a more direct, and actually maybe my brightest moment in the history of soccer writing. I got a kind of supportive tweet from Andres Cantor, you know, the commentator on Univision, about that article. So, they ended up with a title that's of course they give you the title for these things. You don't choose them, but it's called Soccer Without the Melodrama, No Thanks, which is probably not a title I would have chosen, but anyway, that's the title. But you know, one of the problems was just that the VAR stuff was really just coming in as I was writing, and I'm not sure that I had fully processed it. So it kind of, my chapter on the referee addresses it, in a sense, and also is much larger meditation on, you know, why I find the role of the referee in soccer to be a particularly fascinating thing to watch, precisely because of the humanity of it and the possibility of error and, you know, and what it, so in the book, I just sort of present the referee as one of the, as one of the actors in the drama, you know, not a kind of a sort of space of objectivity and justice, but I mean, obviously that's part of their role, but I sort of see them as part of the theater. So that's kind of my take on it. And I think that the VA, you know, and the reason I'm hesitant about VAR, I'm less hesitant, like a lot of people, about goal line technology, which seems to me is, you know, a different kind of thing, but VAR, I think, really is a kind of Trojan horse of sorts, in a sense that there isn't really any reason why you shouldn't continually increase the number of things that you use VAR for once you start using it. And also, I really do think that the ultimate role of VAR will simply to be to nourish arguments about the referee's calls more. I mean, I think it's, in some cases there will be, you know, some clarity given for it, but it seems to me that the nature of the laws of the game and the referee's role will lend, that the ambiguity of things will not be eliminated by VAR, but may actually just be augmented by them in the end. But we'll see, you know. And I do think it's, so I am definitely concerned about it in a way that I think is, and, you know, in some ways the angle, my reading of the sport, I mean, goes in that particular direction. And I think it's, you know, it's definitely an angle, but my own sense is that I tend to emphasize and love the theatricality and the fact of unfairness. This is really following Pombergé to some extent. I see that as one of the reasons why it's so beloved all over the world and provides so much to talk about. So that's kind of my argument, is that I'm not sure why, you know, I'm always not sure why people feel like they need to perfect soccer, since it seems like it's like literally the most successful form of culture in the history of humanity. In terms of its spread. So I don't really, like, the why it needs to be fixed has always kind of puzzled me, or why people think it needs to be fixed. But, you know, I know that there's different takes on that.
Thank you. Mine is that it's in the name of fair play, but I'll leave it with that. Thank you. I'm going to check out your article. That's great.
Okay. Thanks.
Open up a tiny space for organic conversation here before we move away from VAR. Peter, did you want to chime in on this? And then I can turn to Andrew's type check question.
I followed VAR in Serie A this year from the very first week, where my team got screwed immediately in the first use of it. And I was against it initially for many of the same reasons that Laurent has put forward. And I must say, I've changed my opinion on it. The referees and the assistants have had to improve the way they use it, and they have gotten better over time. They went through a period where they were using it too much, they were taking too long to make the decisions, etc. But I have to say, in the second half of the season, it's been used judiciously, and by and large, it's been used well. It's been used well in instances precisely where I think it can help. And that is to judge, for example, in a fast-flowing attacking motion where the tackle of the defender is very close to the line in the box, and the player will fall a meter, 2 meters inside the box, and at first sight it looks clearly like a penalty. And then you suddenly see the replay from the camera, particularly sort of pitch level, and you see clearly that the foul is, you know, amply outside the box.
Yeah.
In a nil-nil game, you know, you've got 10 players defending in 30 meters behind the ball, and there's no space. You know, frequently these dead ball situations, and of course penalties being the most important ones, can be the only chance you get to score. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, handballs, you know, so we're still going to discuss whether they're voluntary, involuntary, and all of that, of course. But it's helped in that respect as well, because, you know, like the cross from the wing with the player half turning his head, you know, how far is the arm from the body kind of thing. It's very tough to judge that in real time. But if you give it a second look and you get three different angles, I've seen, you know, calls reversed. Which in Italy is astounding, where the home team gets a call reversed against it. I mean, we never used to see that. And I think that's very healthy. And, you know, the fans' reaction has been a lot more constructive, not all the time, but has been a lot more constructive than I worried. You know, like, people accept it. You know, they're like, okay, the referee screwed up. They looked at it and they got it right. There's really little to complain about. And you're right. It does take away from the theatrics and the, you know, the soap opera element to it. But I also have come to appreciate its value as you know, sometimes we need a little less soap opera. Sometimes we just need to get the call right
and move on.
And so in the Real Madrid Juventus game, which Alex, I'm sure, will feel differently about. I mean, if that foot crime on football, you know, had been looked at again, there's a slight chance that you would have seen that there was no way that that was a foul to give him the penalty. I mean, it's not possible that so many eyes would all at the same time get it wrong. But without VAR, with just the goal assistant, they didn't feel comfortable overruling the referee, and that ended up, it was very theatrical, but I mean, it was ruinous so many ways. So yeah, I think we should keep an open mind, because it'll take time to get it right, and maybe the World Cup is not the right competition to introduce it, but I think it can be done right, and I think it can help football, and it may even help reduce incidents of violence, perhaps.
I think that's all really powerful. I mean, I'll be definitely curious in the World Cup. And I think part of it, I think there needs to be a lot of skepticism about it precisely to make sure that it's kind of used in the right ways. You know, I think that's partly the technologism has to be placed in dialogue with other things. Right. And there's a way in which technologism can sometimes have a, you know, kind of steamroller effect. But that's really interesting to hear that you think that, that in the particular Serie A case, I haven't had enough, you know, deep experience of watching game after game with it to make, you know, so I have this kind of, I think like a lot of other people, kind of a fear of it, but maybe it's irrational, you know.
It's also funny because, you know, I make fun of Real Madrid because Alex is on the call and because they stole the game from us. But, you know, in Italy, they say the same thing about my team, right, about Juve. And what's incredible is during the season, everyone was against VAR. Because this problem and that problem. And now that Napoli is 1 point behind and is probably going to end up winning the league, everyone's in favor of it because they say, you see, we brought VAR in and now Juve doesn't win anymore.
That's funny. Of course. And the power of, I think, the culture of the game, I mean, we'll be able to absorb all these things and continue to have them be the source of conversation.
That's not going away.
Yeah, and that, and the morality questions of these things. I mean, it just interests, you know, and I do also think that the kind of culture around soccer is powerful enough that, you know, we're not going to suddenly turn into like American football or something in the use of technology or whatever. So I do, you know, I think that's, there is still, and I think it's, you know, it's really interesting to sort of see the change. I do also think, you know, part of it is, as, and it's relating to the earlier question a little bit, which is, I'm fascinated by the different ways in which we now consume football, right? And part of it is like the use of social media, the way in which we can kind of cultivate and curate our own videos of things and then argue about them endlessly. So there is a way in which just the technological matrix has shifted, not just in terms of the actual game itself, but in terms of the ways in which we visualize the game. And that, of course, I mean, I do think there's a kind of symbiosis between those two. Not to mention the video game stuff, you know, so there's a lot happening in terms of the virtual and the real in football today that I think is, you know, going to be super interesting to follow. I give my students the opportunity, I say they either have to play or watch a soccer game, and once or twice they're allowed to just play like a FIFA video game soccer match, you know, and report on that. But it's interesting how many of them are actually relating to the sport through the virtual in ways as well. And of course that's interesting too, in terms of how people come to think about fairness or unfairness, since they may have changed this, but one question I always ask them about FIFA, the video game, is whether there's a way to turn on referee errors, you know, or kind of like make it so the referees call offside wrong or something, which I don't know if that exists yet, but I've always thought that's kind of interesting that wasn't a feature that they built in from the beginning.
Great. I will resist the bait. And
that's very challenging for you, I admit.
And we'll just outline that it's fascinating to hear all the angles that we can bring to VAR. I'm very interested to see in the next few years how this develops across leagues. It seems like the Bundesliga has had a very different experience from what I've read from players' perspectives. There was a survey taken at the start of the season on VAR, was generally favorable. Towards the middle of it, I think, is when I read this story, the players had all turned on it. But obviously, the devil's in the details, the implementation, the standout cases that are providing, you know, the examples for a public. But it really speaks to how much the context of the particular games, the particular instances, can be the contingencies that will determine how VAR will be implemented. Because as a big hockey fan, you know, I'm still torn about this because I see offsides decisions and goaltender interference decisions when it benefits my team as a crucial improvement in how referees have these tools now. But I don't celebrate goals the same way as I used to. I've noticed a very different way, and this is something that players have talked about, the question of looking to see if it stands, although that could also be leveled against the offsides rules. But we'll leave all that as a bucket of angles to take from the VAR debate and return to the language of the game. I'd like to ask a question on behalf of Andrew Lee at NYU, who says, I also teach a class, a football class at NYU, and I'm always a little surprised by the little of the past my students know, despite being international and or dedicated fans. I hold up my IK edition of Galeano's Fútbol a Sol y Sombra, and the students don't recognize Maradona. So I'm curious if you find this as well. The sport exists as a thing in the moment, but not as a historical subject in its own right. And that's from Andrew to you, Vaughn.
Oh yeah, I definitely find that. And I think it's quite fascinating. I mean, and even, you're right, even kind of things that you would expect them to see. It's why, in a way, a lot of what I do in the class is basically just, you know, work through the history of the sport and present them these various personalities. I mean, this year I used Kittleson's book, used Brilliant Orange, you know, used different material on Maradona. So there's a definitely, I think that's part of it. And in writing the book, I did want to, you know, I did choose, you know, Cruyff and Maradona and the Brazilian team of 58 and 70 to, you know, to just to get and give people basic literacy on things that I feel like should be, you know, kind of part of the conversation as well. So I do think that's interesting. And that's coupled with sort of like incredibly in-depth micro knowledge about the latest transfer rumors or whatever, you know, they're kind of, but it does help them. I think gaining perspective, getting them to step back a little bit from whatever forms of fandom they have right now and sort of see how that's also kind of historically constituted by the particular moment we're in, vis-a-vis the, you know, the market of the sport and the media of the sport and those sorts of things. And even just explaining to them, you know, that a lot of things that we consider natural are, you know, they're the result of things that have happened roughly from the 80s and 90s, I think is useful there too. So, I mean, I like to use the places where they are really passionate and then kind of, but then help them kind of put that in context to some extent as well. So, and that definitely shaped the book as well. So I wanted a mix of the fairly, you know, classic stories that everybody should kind of know, I guess, the canon of sorts, you know, so, or at least part of the canon, and then things that people aren't familiar with to kind of be combined in the book as well. So that, you know, there'd be kind of both of those. So.
Great. Thanks. Another question from Patrick.
Okay. Thank you. Well, first of all, yeah, you know, I want to, you know, reiterate to Laurent, thank you for meeting with us today. And then, you know, I'm about halfway through the book. It's great. It's easy to read. And I'm actually preparing a course on soccer, literary representations of soccer next spring. Now, I know that you've taught several courses on, you know, soccer and politics, and you were talking a little bit about what materials you're using in your course. I kind of wanted to know if you would, if you're going to plan on using this text in your classes, in the preparation of your courses, and then working in a literature department in literary studies, what types of literary texts do you weave into your courses? I know you mentioned the Villoro quote about drama, and then, you know, games already producing their own drama, but I didn't know if you could comment a little bit on how you weave some of these literary texts into your courses, or if any. Thank you.
Yeah, and so the course here itself is taught in multiple languages. So I teach it in Romance Studies, and there's an English language lecture on Tuesdays, and then Thursdays they meet in different sections, English, French, Spanish, and Italian this year. I've also had German and Portuguese sections. So each of those is led by a TA. These are kind of native speakers who all are soccer fans, actually, of different, you know, one from Mexico, one from Marseille, and one from Roma, actually. So she had a fun semester. But so that allows me to have each of them read different kind of works. In the French section, I wish I would want to have more novels. This year, the Spanish read, the one novel they read was the Eduardo Sacheri, Papeles en el Viento, you know, which actually I realize now is translated into English. So they read that novel, the Spanish section, and that was, I think that was good, but it's a long novel, and so we have to figure out how to teach it better. One that works really well in French is Fatou Diome's Le Ventre de l'Atlantique, which I think is translated actually too, which is in a way, I mean, it's really a story about kind of Senegal and migration, but at the heart of it is football as well. And, you know, I quote in the book a fair amount the kind of letters, the Ekelund Nausgaard letters, which I think are kind of interesting. Then in Italian, I actually have to remember, she brought in a couple of short stories into her smaller section as well. But I think it'd be great actually to, at some point, I don't know if we can do this as an FSF thing or something, but to really make some sort of bibliography or compendium of works of short stories and novels that people have taught and what's successful in different languages. Because I do think it's really interesting. I suppose I would take, they also read, of course, I'd read Eduardo Galeano, which I think of as a work of literature, and read it in different languages as well. So, I mean, I suppose I would, you know, and I think it's interesting to think about all these different forms of cultural representation from there's also art right now. There's an exhibit at the Perez Art Museum that's, you know, had a few iterations, that Franklin Sermons put together. So there's the kind of world of contemporary art and football, which I think is growing as well. So it's a great point. And I sometimes, the balance between sort of doing the history and the structural and economic aspects and maybe spending more time on this artistic area, I think in some ways I'd like to do more of the latter. And I think probably a lot of courses are taught in various romance studies or literature departments as well, from what I understand. Probably there's, you know, a lot of knowledge being built up about how to do that as well. So I'd really love to actually do this course with sections in other languages as well, potentially Arabic and Chinese is kind of one of my goals, if I can figure out how to make that work here. Because I imagine there's probably a lot out there that I personally don't know about.
Thank you so much for that. And again, congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
It's a great idea. We might be able to act on in the near future. We have the film, the football films list up on the website, A literature list would be probably a lot more ambitious, but really useful for all of our teaching. So we'll follow up on that.
I was just going to say, I just feel like there's probably a lot of novels where there are football scenes, you know, sure. There's kind of, I think maybe less that are directly on that. But I think that could be kind of interesting. And especially in the realm of short story or poetry or those kinds of things, I imagine that, you know, there might be just sort of occasional things here and there where a writer wrote about it. And I also do think that there's probably some, you know, there are articles, there are journalistic articles or pieces of writing that to me reach the level of literature, you know. That might be an interesting point to include, just, you know, particularly beautiful essays written about soccer, but in a literary vein or style. So.
Great. Well, we'll echo Peter's call for volunteers in the chat to the network. Let's turn to Andrew Guest with a question.
Thanks. Like everybody else, enjoyed the book very much. Definitely going to be doing a World Cup class this summer and definitely going to integrate at least the fandom chapter. I think great for students and for everybody. I come at this stuff a little more as a social scientist than I think most of the rest of the group. And so one of the questions I was curious about as I was reading through, obviously this, you're a humanist and a humanities type, and so that's where this is coming from. But I'm just sort of curious, with some of the topics I kind of felt like, oh, there's so much good kind of social science that could be woven in, things like, you know, around the penalty kick stuff with the goalkeepers, or the kind of science of, you know, the stats and the analytics and the management, and also the fandom and the kind of the psychology of fandom, that was not there for, again, and that's not, I know what this book was about, but I'm partially kind of curious if you just, and I may already know the answer to this based on your VAR discussion, but do you just not have any use for that? Do you think that stuff, the kind of burgeoning science of soccer is problematic on its own, or is it just not sort of your point of focus? And I think maybe a little bit related, this is a little tangential, but just to squeeze in a second question, I'm a little curious more about the audience that you had in mind, and we've talked some about it being, you know, related to the U.S. Failing to qualify for the World Cup. I assume this is mostly for a U.S. audience. But I'm curious if you had in mind, you know, writing for, whether it was really for introducing to American soccer fans, or if you had in mind readers that would be in other places. And I'm curious about that partially because I do think sometimes when you're writing for an American audience, there's things you don't take for granted that you might take for granted in writing for other audiences that are more deeply immersed in soccer cultures. And I actually think sometimes that can be a good thing for soccer writing because it forces you to think more clearly and sort of elaborate. You can't take things for granted that you might otherwise take for granted. But yeah, so distantly related, but two questions, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, I'll talk about the second one first. I do feel like it's interesting because I've even gotten responses from England I had this experience in another context when I wrote my history of Haiti. I thought, okay, I'm really writing this for people in the US, you know, people in Haiti know a lot of this stuff and that's my goal, you know, I'm kind of orienting it. And then came to realize that actually because I was doing that, I was actually writing things in a way that people in Haiti hadn't written before and in a way that was actually kind of useful, like partly precisely sort of saying, I'm going to try to step back and explain this, allows you to do things that and it does strike me that when you read a lot of, I don't mean this as a huge critique, but I read a lot of soccer books and realize that there's a huge amount of assumed knowledge that the writers assume, you know, not only knowledge, but also level of interest, right? So they write as if the a priori, like maybe making the case a little bit less, which I kind of get. I mean, if they're writing for people who are already interested in it, but I also felt like that was kind of a missed opportunity. Like I would enjoy knowing if, you know, people who kind of always thought soccer was really super tedious and not interesting might read this book and kind of alter their sense, right? And that, because that does have to do with the sort of context of the series itself, and what Basic Book was asking was precisely to sort of say, what about if you try to explain to someone who might not actually be interested, how if you kind of understand the culture around this, it becomes interesting, right? So it's, in terms of this, the first question, I mean, it is really just a kind of a disposition of mine, and also just a sense of not understanding, you know, that some of the sociological work or especially the psychology and more mathematical models and those kinds of things, just not quite feeling that well versed enough in it to really kind of to write about it from that angle. It is true that I have a disposition that's more on the kind of, I guess, the sort of Galeone-esque theatrical side of admiring things. But also this was really meant to be a book from when they approached me about the kind of cultural aspects of the game. And there's certainly, I'm like reading, you know, Masters of Soccer now by Grant Wall and, you know, reading things like that. And there's obviously, for those who are immersed in the kind of the game itself, there's obviously a huge amount that's really valuable there. Like I certainly wouldn't deny that in terms of, for one thing, in terms of coaches and players and kind of the use of all of these, whether it's various kinds of models to help improving the game as well. So it's not, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's something that I think that deny the importance of. It's just kind of, I didn't feel like I was the person to really take that on in the way that other people have. So yeah, and I'm seeing that the Away Game, which is a book, is coming up in the discussions as well, which I like a lot too. I'm actually writing a review of that and of Gwendolyn's book for The Atlantic that'll come out in July. So yeah, it's partly, you know, again, I think one writes hopefully with a sense of one's limitations. And that's what I did in this particular case, or what, you know, what the thing that I could do. And as someone who's also, I mean, I have a strong relationship to soccer, but I'm not, there are certainly like many, many millions of people in the world who probably have had a deeper engagement with it over the course of their lives. Mine was sort of shaped by being, you know, a suburban kid in the US with Belgian roots, but not really. Anyway, you know, so I don't sort of position myself, there's a way in which I think of myself as a little bit both an insider and outsider. So hope and try to mobilize that in service of, you know, making kind of useful observations about it. But yeah, so it's easier to do that because, again, this wasn't a book that's like, unlike some of my more scholarly books where the kind of idea of expertise is the main thing. I think it's a little bit more of a kind of communication exercise. So, but yeah, so I don't know if that answers the question a little bit. I'm curious to sort of think whether, like, if there's going to be translations of it, you know, would it be read in Latin America? And if so, how, you know, it does feel to some extent the Latin American tradition of writing on the sport is maybe the one that I'm the most, like, you know, Villoro and Galeano, like, are the ones that, I don't know if they're the model exactly, but they definitely influenced me in terms of how I think about the sport a lot, perhaps more than like a UK or English tradition in that sense. So
that's great. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the question, Andrew. Little space for a question from anyone else. I have another if no one else wants to jump in. But wanted the opportunity to offer the opportunity to anyone who hasn't asked a question yet or is on this track. Laurent, you've already started to answer this question in a few other responses, but in the acknowledgments, you talk about your blog and the classroom as a place that shaped the way that you're writing the book. I wanted to ask, are there things that students have challenged you on that are specific to the classroom that made you present certain parts of the narrative in certain ways? I'm thinking, on the one hand, a very very kind of more utilitarian instances of this, maybe like explaining the offsides rule in written form as something that would be very useful to have some classroom experience. And I watched the video that Duke put out of the class where you have the students outside to explain how that actually works. And it seems like to also give them a sense of how hard it is for the referee on the line to make that call. But are there other things in the book that were specific classroom discussions that not so much kind of gave you an opportunity to think of how to explain something, but were actually insights from the classroom that may not have necessarily been a challenge from a student, but became more directly out of discussions. Does that make sense, that question?
Yeah. Well, part of it is that it's been this, for me, this incredible laboratory to see how these students think about soccer and what it means in their lives and the different varieties of fandom and relationship to it that they have. Just because it's a pretty interesting contingent, you know, it always includes, you know, students from the Middle East and Africa, as well as American students, you know, who like have for some odd reason, you know, become not an odd reason, but they're, you know, these American students who've like never left the country, who are like incredibly into a particular European team, you know, to like levels of really intense knowledge. And so that's really interesting to me. So in some ways I would say like the fan chapter is definitely, and I say this, you know, in the intro, and the fan chapter is kind of shaped a little bit by just that experience of, and then because they have to write about it and reflect on it, you know, I have a bunch of writing assignments over the course of the semester, just kind of that shapes it. So it does help me think about the forms of knowledge and conversation that exist around the game, and also what, you know, what happens when you push them in different kinds of directions. Certainly it's always been interesting because I've been teaching women's soccer within it, consistently, and then organize these two events around that. So those have been critical in terms of moving away from my own ignorance and learning about that in order to teach it. Obviously then laid the foundation for doing that in the book as well. So that maybe came less from the students who, I mean, there are some obviously who are interested in that, but who tend to have a much more, often a very masculinist view of the sport. But figuring out how to kind of bring that in and I think try to compel them to think about the sport and gender in ways has been sometimes challenging and interesting. In part, you know, because partly the students do sometimes respond the way that other people often respond about it. So trying to figure out how do you kind of deal with those sorts of responses. And so that's that. That are the two that come to mind the most clearly. So. It's also true that like when I was writing the book, I just structured my lectures around positions. So that was a way for me to sort of say, okay, like I've got to give a lecture today on the goalie. Like, what are the stories I'm going to tell? What am I going to pull together? So it wasn't necessarily a challenge coming back from the students, but just simply the challenge of sort of saying, I've got, you know, 75 minutes and I want to make this really fun and interesting for them, and use moments, you know, use videos and that kind of stuff. So that helped. The structures of lectures definitely shaped the structures of the course. I mean, sorry, of the book itself, in somewhat critical ways. And I mean, I did that on purpose. Once I knew I was writing the book, I was like, okay, I'm going to reorganize the class from a more chronological form, which I used to have, to this kind of form around players. So, yeah, I mean, it's been, again, I think having the opportunity to teach it, which has been great, and it's been, you know, really nice to have that support here, is definitely one of the foundations for being able to write the book. And I don't know if I would have taken on the book if I hadn't had that experience enough to know, you know, how I would to already be able to imagine how I might write it.
Great, thanks. Anyone else? Oh, Andrew has another question, so let's turn to him.
Yeah, unless anybody else wants to go on.
No, all yours.
I just wanted to follow up. You've mentioned several times this idea of wanting to make sure that women's soccer was a central part of the book, and I think that's great, and it's compelling, and it's interesting to see that woven throughout so sort of seamlessly. I guess I'm curious about that also in relation to audience, because my observation with the women's game is that there's so much, there is a lot of great writing about it and great thinking and super interesting stuff going on. But, and this is partially from my own experience years ago blogging, where, you know, you'd write something stupid about the men's game and it would get lots of attention, and you write something really interesting and thought-provoking about the women's game and it would get almost no attention. And I'm just curious how you mentioned that part of the goal of the book is to speak to people who might not otherwise be interested in soccer. And it seems like weaving that women's soccer piece in is an extra layer of that challenge. And I'm just curious sort of to hear more about how you approach that. And also, you know, if you have gotten any, you mentioned you've gotten some early responses. I know the book hasn't been out for long, but if you have gotten any sort of responses to that, like how has that gone over, even if it's maybe just from the editors and things along those lines?
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I definitely think that's the case. It was kind of a, you know, sometimes you just try to imagine the world as you want it to be, as opposed to how it is, right? And so that's kind of how I did in writing. You know, I sort of was like, okay, I'm just going to imagine a space in which, you know, and this is being pressed on it after, you know, conversing with Gene Williams and a lot of other folks at the conferences we've had here, just what if we just sort of assume that the history of soccer can never be talked about without the women's and men's game kind of their presence, as that's just how you think about the history of soccer, right? And that is really different than the way we tend to write and think about the game. So it's definitely kind of aspirational more than, it's not a reflection of the way that it tends to be done. So, but that was, you know, I felt I had the freedom in this case to do that. It helps to some extent that I was writing in it for a US publisher and a US audience where, you know, clearly there's, you know, a fair interest, right? And there's a lot of readers who are interested in women's soccer, potentially at least, you know, so I think that was the idea. And there's a side to it, which is that, you know, a lot of times, and I had learned this when writing about Haiti too, it's not, a lot of times when people just learn about this, you know, and they learn about the history of, you know, early women's soccer in the 19th and early 20th century England and those sorts of things, you know, it's not like they're aggressively against learning, you know, they kind of tend to go, oh, wow, why didn't I know that, you know? And that's a bit of the response. I mean, even from radio interviews that I've done on sports shows and that kind of stuff, we very frequently end up focusing on the women's soccer part. So, you know, so that just felt like a kind of contribution to sort of normalize that. And it's building on, obviously, people who've been working on doing that for a long time. I do think we're in a little bit of a, hopefully a slightly different space where things are changing somewhat. And, you know, like the Burn It All Down podcast and the work of people, of Brenda and Shireen and Jean and all these folks and Gwendolyn's book are getting more attention. So it just felt like a way of like participating in that project. And that was important to me in writing it. I do think, you know, we have to kind of imagine a different way of thinking about it as kind of a basis. And I know one was Elliot at Africa as a Country, who I wrote for earlier, was sort of, I mean, he was sort of saying like, I'm not sure how like English readers will respond to that, having women's sports so prominent, you know, and, or maybe they'll think this is great, you know. So I think that I'm interested to see if there'll be pushback on that. And partly wanting to see, to provoke that that response, to see what form it takes, you know, and what the arguments are, just to kind of draw out that question a little bit too. But that's definitely, you know, I realize it's sort of a, you know, it's a maybe a risk in some ways, but I also think that the idea was, it's in a way, and it's not even something, it's interesting because like the marketing of the book doesn't say anything about that, which was a little bit willed, you know, and so it doesn't sort of say on the back of the book, like with a focus on women's soccer or something. And none of the blurbs make that point, which I actually was glad about, and the packaging of the book. So that's part of the idea too. It's just sort of, you know, for me, it's sort of like, oh, we're talking about soccer. So so obviously we're talking about both women's and men's game. Again, that's kind of a proposal that may be how we should do it going forward. You know, not doesn't have to be followed by others, but that just seemed to me the right thing to do at this particular moment. I noticed, I'm sorry, one as a, that the away game also came up, and I think it would be great to have him on. Well, Grant Wall, when he was here, mentioned that he's very close friends with Sebastian, so might be very easy to get in touch with him, because I think he would be a great, that's a really wonderful book and would be an interesting person to, and actually going back to Andrew's earlier point about the technical, the training aspects, that is one of the things I really liked about that book, was the focus on that kind of question of coaching and match intelligence and all those sorts of things. So just to add to that stream on the chat.
That's great. No, thank you for providing that enchufe, as we would say. Have time for maybe two more questions. We can ask the penultimate through Peter.
Yeah, actually the discussion that's sort of organically growing linked to the away game made me think of something I've been working on quite a bit lately, writing about football from a young person's perspective, as opposed to boring professors like us, or not so boring in some cases. That the way that young people, and by young I mean teenagers and perhaps even below, sort of the way that they look at soccer and the way they understand soccer and the way they speak about soccer, football, etc., is quite different from how we see it and think about it and talk about it. And I was wondering, Laurent, if there are parts of the book where you think the perspective of youth might illuminate the analysis in different ways, as opposed to the perspective of the adult, of the parent, of the intellectual, and so on, because that's the position that most of us here are familiar with, you know. And sort of how does soccer also act as a kind of intergenerational field and you know, and language too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, I mean, it goes back to, that's one of the reasons why teaching has been fun, because it's been, you know, these are basically like 19, 20, 21 year old people who have grown up in a different kind of world than I, in terms of just how they relate to the sport. And I myself, I mean, I write about it early in the book, that like a lot of my relationship to the sport is based on like kids, you know, playing as a kid. I didn't then play, you know, at like high school levels or other areas. So that kind of shapes my take. And I do like in, you know, some of the places that I use, like it's Thuram or Drug Buzz Autobiography, those sort of sections on the kind of early relationship to the sport have always struck me as well. And just the broader sense of the, you know, not losing the sense of play in the whole, in all of the other structures that we talk about. So I think that was, again, that was partly the tone of the book is, you know, is more enthusiastic than critical, partly because I'm trying to get at those, you know, get back to that stuff. And it was hard in a way because it's such a cliche on some level, right? It's like every FIFA ad or whatever. But, you know, there's a way in which, you know, behind every cliche there's some sort of truth, so that there is this kind of sense of I try to remain sort of surprised and interested at the fact that this sport has the kind of place that it has in so many places, and to kind of keep that sense of wonder and curiosity about that as part of the point. And again, because I was, you know, I'm just sort of imagining various readers who who might be coming in with that open attitude, or mostly, and in fact, a certain number of readers who are basically probably maybe their dominant experience of the game is their kids playing it and their kids being into it. Or maybe some other form, but that I do think that in this place, the idea of the sport as a child's or kids youth sport is so dominant in the United States. That's the place where it has that kind of biggest presence culturally as well. So I definitely was trying to orient it towards some sense of that while also integrating these other things as well. So
yeah, I mean, not just as players, I mean, as fans, as consumers, mm-hmm. and in many cases, even as commentators. I mean, you know, like there's this whole world of youth interaction of various kinds, you know, around football that we as adults really don't understand and don't get to see. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what is also interesting of the phenomenon of soccer, you know, because uh-huh. as you indicated, you know, there's a nostalgia in a lot of what we write about and what keeps us alert and curious about, you know, how it was when we were 12. and sometimes that's very healthy to get in touch with your inner 12-year-old. But I mean, there's also like this whole other stuff, and the kids are being targeted as consumers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, they're reacting to that in very interesting ways, and in unpredictable ways, as kids tend to be. Anyway, I don't mean to introduce things that are completely out of left field, but I was thinking about this also in relation to the discussion about the away game, which is really a story directed by adults that stars young people, which mm-hmm. is also very. Yeah. Weird in that way, no? I mean, every decision, everything that happens, the people who are pulling every string are the adults, and center stage are these often amazing kids.
Whose trajectories are not particularly great in all games, right? I mean, there's a...
No, not at all, not
I
at all.
That book really
that's cool. how it works, but yeah. that's how it works.
Yeah.
And so that... I feel like that's the reality, you know, 1 in 12,000, you know, that's the reality. What happens to the other 11,000?
Yeah. And that's kind of, it's true. I think that's really, that one of the things I really like about the away game is precisely that it's very soft and it's, you know, it's on surface, it's this very kind of appealing story, but the critique that, you know, that you would get in other books about kind of contemporary African soccer comes through, I think, in a quite powerful way, but it is interesting. And I think there's a way in which reading that book, you're reminded of the madness, you know, that's part of it too, right? Is to sort of step back and be like, wait, what the hell, right? You know, why is this going on? Especially when it has to do with young players. That I found, so because when they asked me at the Atlantic to write about this book, I asked them if I could also write about Gwendolyn's book, because I actually think that's really interesting how she also deals with this very different context and what the love of the game as a kid sort of ends up doing, or where it brings you for women versus men, and how that kind of operates is pretty interesting too. And so yeah, I think the other thing is, I mean, this semester I ended up watching, sort of, we just set up like my students organized watching Champions League games in their dorms, you know, so I would go and it's just like incredibly funny, not funny in a bad way, but just really fascinating to just listen to them watch a game and the way that they kind of talk while the game is going on and the amount of information that they have, like that they're sort of like packed with this kind of set of knowledges. This very immediate set of knowledges about the players and everything that I think is—it's not that I think fans have always had that, but it's just sort of the fact of their kind of informational excess, maybe not excess, but just this kind of facility of having material information that's kind of constantly updated is sort of interesting. So it's this kind of so that's been really fun actually to sit there and listen to how these 20-year-olds like talk, what they talk about when a game is on. Which is very different from what I tend to talk about. people's hair and tattoos is what I'm mostly interested in, which doesn't interest them at all for some reason. I don't know why.
Great. Well, we're in the 89th minute. So I think I'll just take the opportunity to, again, thank Laurent for taking the time to speak with the group about the book. And is there anything in particular you'd like to close with, Laurent, about the acknowledgement to the group that kind of serves as a, you know, as a point of reflection for all of us to think about continuing to use this forum for our work. You know, the ways that we talk about recent scholarship obviously informed the way that you might have written through mm-hmm. some of the scholarship in the book, but are there other ways you found it useful, or are there things that we could create more space for?
I mean, I do think that two things. One is that I think, you know, for me, participating in the group, I was sort of liberating in terms of writing the book, in the sense of just feeling like the book is just a part of a big conversation, right? So it wasn't that I had to, you know, that I could figure out what my place in the conversation would be without a sense that it had to be the whole conversation, if that makes sense, you know, that it would be one angle on it. And that is, I think, important and liberating when you're trying to write a book, which could have felt a burden to sort of somehow represent, you know, all the angles instead of being able to sort of say, okay, well, my angle will be this. So that's, I think, you know, and knowing that there are other works, you know, other books in the works and other people kind of going to bring out different sorts of things, I think is really important. I mean, I do feel like it's in writing this, and this maybe links to our question about the literature. The very specific questions of style and writing when we write about soccer, I think to me are really interesting. And, you know, both the constraints, because if we're writing again in more disciplinary spaces, you know, for particular kinds of journals, or if we're writing within history versus social science and those sorts of things. But then also the aspirational question of like what kind of writing we might want to do around soccer outside of those constraints is kind of an interesting one to me too. So that's just one thought, is that the stylistic issues I think are interesting, because I do think soccer poses a particularly interesting problem of, you know, around narrative and style and like, because it's at once the sort of a space of incredible cliches and a space of profusive language all the time, you know, like people are constantly talking about it. So how to then, like, what the written form that is through which we most usefully engage with it, and the role of writing in relationship to soccer seems like obviously a concern for everybody in this group in one level. So, I mean, I don't know exactly how one addresses that directly, but I've definitely enjoyed thinking about that with the group.
Great. Well, thank you, and thanks everyone for joining us. We'll be in touch soon about our next session.
Thanks a lot for having me today. I really appreciate the chance to talk about the book.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks, everyone.